Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
It's wonderful to be here in this room with people who are coaching church planters, and I would like to give a short presentation and then invite your questions, and we can learn a lot more, perhaps more, through question and answer than just through a presentation. But I'll start with the story of the man who went into a tavern at about 5 o'clock in the afternoon, and he ordered two beers, one for him and one for his friend, but he was alone. And the bartender gave him, two beers, and the next day he comes in and he says, alone, two beers, please, one for me and one for my friend, but he was alone. He did this day after day, week after week, and then all of a sudden, one day, he walks in, same time, he's alone, and he says to the bartender, the same guy, one beer, please. And the bartender says, what? What? One beer? You've been coming in here every day for weeks now, ordering two beers, one for you and one for your friend. And he said, yeah, but I've stopped drinking. Blessed is the man and the woman who does not have this person as his coachee in the church planting process. It is a wonderful to be involved in church planting, but we know that the work of church planting is very strenuous and oftentimes fraught with discouragement. And what saves people in church planting is people who come alongside them, parakletos, kinds of people like the Holy Spirit, to encourage them and to shepherd them into good results. Good coaching will always result in good results, and that will buoy the soul of the church planter. So, but I'm going to talk about mistakes and lessons that we can learn in church planting coaching. Specifically about what we can do wrong in planting churches or coaching people in church planting. One of the big mistakes is not having a model of church planting from which to go from when we coach our people. Oftentimes, we don't know what the model of church planting is that this person is following that we are coaching, and that can be fraught with problems. If we don't know the road that he's on, it's difficult for us then to be with him on this road. So, not knowing what is his route that he's taking in order to plant this church is a mistake that we can make. In my book, The Jesus Model: Planting Churches the Jesus Way, I talk about my coaching system. You can read about that. And then about the four phases of church planting that we've been using in Germany for 20 years now, probably. There's a start team phase where you, in the first 6 to 8 months, you will generate your starter team, both Christians and non-Christians, who will then be the genesis of this new church. You will give yourself a profile. You will pray together. You will talk about how you will be making disciples and evangelism is involved in disciple making. Discipleship has to do with beginning to disciple people before they're Christians. Go and make disciples of all nations. The ta ethne are the heathen. So discipleship always begins before conversion. So how do we do that? That's all in the starter team phase. That takes 6 to 8 months, and you should, by the end of this phase in an urban area, have between 15 and 25 people in an urban area in your starter team. We say starter team and not core group because a core group is often static. It doesn't allow new people in. It is static. It doesn't grow. So we talk about a starter team, which allows new people to come in from month to month. So it's growing. You want it to be growing. Every phase in the church planting process needs to be dynamic. It needs to have a forward movement. Otherwise, you have problems in the project itself and in the demeanor of the church planter and his team. So the first phase is the starter team phase. You're building it up. The second phase is the preview service phase. So when you go to a movie theater, before the major movie is shown that you have just paid money for, what they do is they show you trailers of movies that will come. They're teasers. They want to awaken interest so that you would go to that movie. Well, a preview service is something like a teaser, a trailer in the movie theater. It is putting one worship service on a month, showing people the way the service will be before the church is planted, but the church is not yet planted. This is all before you're planting or planted. And to do that, what you need is people from outside, Christians from outside your team, to help you put on these preview services. So they would covenant with you to do this for the next two phases. But their project is just to put on the worship service. And you need four kinds of people. You need musicians, you need technicians, you need people to do children's ministry, and you need somebody for food services. You can't plant...
Could you repeat the four?
Yes, sure. You need musicians. You need technicians, so people to do the sound, the lighting, maybe the PowerPoint, if you have that. You need children's workers. And you need somebody to work on food and beverages. You can hardly plant a church in Europe today without something to drink. It doesn't have to be beer, okay, in a European context. It can be some other beverage. But without something to drink and to eat, especially after the service, people have to hold on to something. And they hold on to a cup of coffee or tea or a plate of something, finger food. But if you put that in your starter team, these four areas, what you do is you overburden the people in your starter team. They have no capacity left to connect with visitors. And a relational building is the glue that builds a church. Think about this. Think about visitors in your church ministry, your church planting ministry, that are like a block of Lego or Duplo. Suppose this were Lego, okay? It is a block of Lego, and the Lego, it's a piece in and of itself, but it's not pressed onto any other piece. So when he comes in or she comes into your church planting sphere, what you need to do is try to emotionally and relationally press him onto other people in your starter team. The more people he gets pressed onto, the greater the possibility that he will stay in your team. But in order to do that, your people have to have open hearts and free hearts to do the relational building. But if they're doing three or four different ministries during this time, they're closed. They can't do that. So this is a secret. You need to do more than greet new people. You need to try to assimilate new people. Assimilate. Not just greet, assimilate. And the way to do that, especially when after you've planted the church and it is growing, you will try to hook up new visitors with people who are in your church who've been there just recently, under 2 years. If you've been in a church setting over 2 years, you are relationally full, saturated. You have been pressed on and on top and below. You have no capacity for new friends or relationships. That's why oftentimes when you, and I say you generically, when you say to your people, you need to be open for new people. You need to greet them. You need to enter into conversations. You need to build relationships with these new people. Well, the people that have been in your church for 2 years or longer, they say, I would love to. But I have no capacity. I'm saturated. I'm relationally full. So don't blame them. And don't blame the older small groups for not being able to assimilate these people. They won't do it. They can't do it. So you need to press new people on to newer people. That's just a little bit of an aside here. But ideally, in the second phase, the start, the preview service phase, you want in an urban setting between 40 and 60 people attending these once a month worship services. So your goal is critical mass. The third phase is the intensive phase. You would dissolve the starter team, and then you would put people in small groups that are growing, with leadership, of course, that would have an expiration date from the start. The expiration date would, or not the expiration date, but the multiplication date, to be more positive, would be a year and a half. Every year and a half, you want to divide or multiply your small group. If you don't say that at the start, people will be disgruntled when you say, you know, along the way, oh, by the way, we're going to divide or multiply in 3 months. They won't get it, and they won't like it, and they won't want it, and you'll get a pushback, and it won't happen. Groups that stay together for 2 years or longer won't multiply. They won't divide. It has to happen under 2 years, and a good marker is about a year and a half. So you dissolve the starter team, you put people into growing small groups, and then you intensify the preview services. You have two preview services a month. And there you want to, after 6 to 8 months, get over the 70 barrier. This is the great major barrier, both in North America and in Europe, the 70 barrier in urban areas. In rural areas, you cut the number in half. But 70 is the number in which everybody in that church can know everybody personally. The big draw in a small church is we are community, we are family. Look, pay attention to the terminology of a small church. They'll talk about family. We're family. They think that this is wonderful, this is beautiful, and it is to a certain extent. When you bump up in the 60s and up to 70, what happens is the atmosphere in your church begins to change. You get the sense that we're disconnected, that we don't know each other the way we once knew each other. In fact, there are people here that I don't even know. When you get beyond 70, you cannot personally know everybody in your fellowship. And that changes the atmosphere, and that's why many Christians say, this is unspiritual. This should not be happening. This does not feel good. We're not a family anymore. It feels like we're a corporation, a company, but we're not a family anymore. This disturbs me. And what then happens is, either the older members or people in your church plant will leave because they don't feel comfortable anymore, and then the church will go down again to 50 or so and feel like a family again, or the church will not let new people get pressed onto to people in your church. They will push them away. So in the church planting process, one of our major goals in urban areas is to succumb the 70 barrier from the start, before you start the church. So we're in the third phase. And the fourth phase is the grand opening, where you will have worship services every week, where you have no second chance to make a first good impression on the people in the city or town in which you're planting your church. You have no second chance to make a good first impression. That's the way it is in life. And when you plant a church, you're only going to plant it once. And when you plant it, your aspiration should be, we will not be overlooked by anybody in this city of 50,000, 100,000, whatever. When we planted our last church in the city of Kaiserslautern in southwestern Germany, we initially started, my wife and I and two singles that moved into our home. We knew nobody in the city of 100,000. So in the first 2 weeks in which we lived in the town, in the city, I made an appointment with the chief mayor, with the deputy mayor of the city, of the Lutheran superintendent, and a journalist at the local paper. I went to them And this is two weeks after moving there. I know nobody. I went to them and I gave them my business card. This is, you need a website before you plant and you need a business card, okay? I went to them, I gave them my business card. I said, my name is Dietrich Schindler. I'm pastor of the Evangelical Free Church here in Kaiserslautern. It's a church that does not yet exist, but will exist and will be important for the citizens of the city. You're an important person. You're important for the city. We need to talk. It was wonderful. Except for the Lutheran superintendent. He was livid. He was so livid. He was so angry. If you want a hobby, you know, if you're, you know, bored with the hobby that you have, spend lots of time with Lutheran and Catholic people and tell them you're planting a church in their town, and you will just, it'll just be amazing. But anyway, the journalist picked up on this, and he said, this is amazing. You know, in our culture, we close churches. We close Lutheran churches, Catholic churches. You're a free church pastor. What's your image of your role? How do you define yourself? What's your profile? And in that year, Kaiserslautern became the German champions in the soccer league. Yeah, you know Kaiserslautern?
Yeah, yeah.
Under Otto Rehhagel. Otto Rehhagel was our coach at that time. And I said to the journalists, I said, oh, I'm like a soccer coach. I train others to live the Christian life daily. I'm like a Christian Otto Rehhagel. Three days later, a half a page in the Rheinpfalz with this caption, a kind of Christian Otto Rehhagel. Pastor Dietrich Schindler starts the first Evangelical Free Church in Kaiserslautern. My picture, big Otto's picture, really small down here. It was beautiful. And as we knew nothing. We thought we were projecting in faith. I was projecting an image of the church that was much bigger than what we were. This is called faith. This is called faith. This is not a lie. This is not a lie. This is called this is called faith. But we said we will give ourselves 6 months to start this church. I mean, this was my fourth church plant in Germany. So I'm experienced, okay? And I'm audacious, I'm full of faith, I take risks, I'm stupid in some ways, but in a good kind of way, stupid. So we said we're going to give ourselves 6 months before we launch. And when we launch, our goal is not to be overlooked by anybody in this city of 100,000 people. And we did a lot in order not to be overlooked. Among other things, we invited a black gospel choir from Boston, Massachusetts, from a Pentecostal church. Brothers and sisters of substance, as they called themselves. All wide body, beautiful brothers and sisters in Christ, with four pieces of luggage each, with regalia and costumes for every day. I mean, it was amazing. They started out saying, we'll send six. It turned out to be 24 people. We went with the choir into the town, the pedestrian zone. They sang in the midst of our city. You know, these are black people, Christians, Pentecostals, singing black gospel and spiritual music. No German can sing this way, you know, or move this way. Germans are not made to move the way blacks. It's beautiful. But within an hour, 3,000 people were gathered around us. 3,000 people. And the papers wrote about it. We did five concerts in a row in a public place, and then had our first worship service in a movie theater, which was our home for the first 2.5 years. And the first service, we had 164 adults present. And then the choir left. And we went down to 35. But then we moved up, and we've been moving up. I mean, I'm not in the church anymore, but that is the grand opening. You know, when a furniture company, a large company in your city opens its door for the first time, It doesn't do it just for a day. The grand opening is not just a day. It's a week. It's a month. It's special things. It's everything to attract a lot of attention. You have no second chance to make a first good impression. So that's the launch. So this is the template that I have in my mind when I coach one of our church planters in Germany. The question is for you as a coach, do you know the model that your church planter is using? And can you coach him according to the model and the phases in which he's in? In the Jesus model, I have for each phase a checklist of things that need to be reached in that phase in order for the church planter to go to the next phase. So a good coach will know this. Not having a model of church planting from which to do the coaching sessions is a failure. Secondly, not having an outcome-based coaching system for church planters is a failure. You know, coaching is like a rubber band. You can pull the rubber band and it gets wider and wider. The coaching terminology is the same way. You know, it's like rubber, or it's like chewing gum. You can pull it and it means different things to different people. For many people who talk about coaching, all it is a better time of drinking coffee with somebody. You shoot the breeze about church planting. How are you doing? You know, what's going on? And can I encourage you? Can I pray for you? That's the coaching. And you've had two cups of coffee. Well, the problem is that it doesn't lead anywhere oftentimes. Great coaching is always outcome-based coaching. And in my book, The Jesus Model, I write about my coaching system that I developed. In German, it's called Palmen. That's the plural for the palm tree, palm. In English, they translate it as P3 and O3. I'll just put the palm in here, and I'll hope that you get it. I'll teach you German in the process here. It won't take 30 years, the way Mark Twain said it would normally take. This is English. I'll always start with the personal. I'll ask, how are you doing? And tell me more. How are you doing? And tell me more. It's an open question. It's wide open. He can talk about his own personal life. He can talk about the ministry at this point. I just want to know, how's he doing? And after he shares, and I will give back to him like a good coach, I will give back to him what he has just said to me in my own words and what I have sensed he felt while he was saying that. Now, I sensed a lot of joy when you were talking about this time you spent with your kids. Or I sensed frustration at the way things are moving in your ministry right now. Is that right? And they'll say, oh, yeah. You need to connect on both levels, the informational level and the emotional level. But you know, this is the difference between coaching and mentoring. If you're a mentor, this is who you are. Mentor was actually the personal name of Homer's, Ulysses' slave when he went off to war. He knew that he was going to go off to war for 10 years, and he had a young boy at home, and he wasn't going to be around to raise this son to manhood. So he left him in the care of Mentor, who was his slave, to raise his son in terms of knowledge and character. So mentoring is taking what you know and pouring it into the person that you're shepherding, the mentee. Coaching is just the opposite. This is the coachee, and you as the coach are taking what is in him and pouring it out. That's the difference in my estimation. So you're taking, he doesn't know what's in him. He does not know. He needs to have that be drawn out. So good coaches draw it up. I'll always talk with about how you're doing, tell me more. I'll give that back. And at that point, I'll pray. Only after I know what to pray about will I pray. The second thing is augenblicklich. This is really easy. What the goals that you gave yourself in our last coaching question, it's the accountability. I would say this is accountability.
Yes, that's great. Let's use accountability. This is English.
So you said you would talk to the mayor and you would talk to three businessmen about your project before we meet this time. How did you do? So I go back and I ask him, you gave yourself these goals, and how well did you do on those goals? The L is Lob auf Deutsch, which means praise, okay?
Ah, Laudatio.
Laudatio as praise. Let's use some Latin here. You will always find something that they did that is praiseworthy. So I praise them for something. Say, yeah, great, you had the time with the mayor. Okay, you didn't have all the, didn't do everything, but you did. This up to this point deals with the past. And then there comes a hinge question, which is the present. And the question is, what is your greatest challenge today? This is the present. And that leads into the future.
My greatest challenge is I can't find a facility in which we can have the launch. You know, I just can't find a large facility.
Then I will talk about the mancos. What are the hindrances to finding a facility? And he will tell me the hindrances, things that keep him from that. This is the Erörterung der Optionen. Just say options. So what are the options that you have to find a new building or a building, a place to which to do the grand opening? You said, well, I could look through the yellow pages. I could put an ad in the paper. I could talk to people about where do they think that are living here in town, where do they think that a place could be. And then you said, okay, now if I've heard you correctly, you've come up with three options. You could you look at the yellow pages, you could put an ad in the paper, you could talk to people who live here. Of those three options, which one is the best one that you think you should do in the next 6 weeks? He says, really, I think I should talk to people who live here and know building space, you know, in our city. So I think I could talk to three people. Okay, and they say, okay, the next time, this is the Neuausrichtung. These are the goals, your new goals. New goals. New goals. So he says, okay, but by the time we meet again in 6 weeks, I will have spoken to three people who live in our city and asked them for suggestions of places in which to do the grand opening. I write that down, and that's where we then do the accountability in the next time. Sometimes I will ask them on a scale of 1 to 10, where 10 is the highest value, how realistic is it that you will reach this goal, you will be able to reach this goal in the next 6 weeks? If he gives himself a 7 or below, I know he won't do it. In the sport coaching literature, this is what good sport coaches do with professional athletes. They do this thing. And they have found if the athlete gives himself a number under 7 or under, he won't do it. So what you do is you revisit the goal. You said, well, let's look at this again. Maybe we should reduce 3 to 2. Talk to 2 people instead of 3. Yeah. So you know a little bit of how successful he may be or not. And your job is to make him successful. That's what your job is. You're not there to frustrate him. So this is results-oriented. Burnout happens in our churches, among other things, because people minister for God and there are no good results over a long period of time. Coaching is a way in which that can be prevented. Get good results. Yeah, oh, I have it written. You have it in your notes. Personal progress page,
praise, obstacles, options, outcomes. Sorry, you have it, you know. You need metrics to which to measure progress, and not having metrics is also a failure. And in the Jesus model, you can have my metrics if you want them, but you can also set up your own. But you need to know what are the next steps that he needs to take in the church planting process and guide him along that, those lines. In coaching, you know that the coach, the term coach doesn't come from the sport world, but it comes from the transportation business where the coach was the coachman. He sat on the stagecoach and he had the reins in his hands and he guided the horses to a goal. He never did the work of the horses. He guided the horses to a goal. He took them from one place to another. And that's what a good coach does. He guides you to good results. What are the issues to which the coach needs to pay particular attention? Well, the personal life of the church planter, for one. The health of his marriage or her marriage. You may have a female church planter. What we need in Europe is many more females to plant churches. We've been doing this exclusively almost among males, but we have gifted females who are leaders, that women that need to be planting churches. Some of our denominations don't allow room for that, but you can do an end around that by saying, these are missionaries. We allow it on the mission field, but not not at home. Okay, anyway. You need to ask them, because most church planting males will not talk about their marriages, because they're driven and their marriage has taken a backseat to the project called the church plant. So you need to address the marriage and talk to the wife too. The emotional health of the woman is a barometer of how healthy the marriage is. Actually, her emotions, her emotional state will tell you how healthy the marriage is. So you need to address the marriage health, the health of his or her life with Jesus. Is joy the predominant emotion in his life or her life? Joy is an indication that he is full of the Spirit of God. So, you know that ministry is loss prone. If we haven't learned to adequately deal with our losses, we will not survive ministry. And sometimes the way that we do the work of God is killing the work of God in us. The way that we are doing the work of God can sometimes kill the work of God in us. Pay very close attention to moods, joylessness, sorrow, depression. These are signs. The ability not to experience joy in joyful situations. These are warning signs that there's something happening in his soul, in his heart, that is not good. It's usually a lost situation that he's not being able to work through. So address his inner life with Jesus, and then you need to guide him to disengage from ministry. You know, Jesus, if you look at Jesus, the way he behaved when he was not in ministry, you see him do two things. He disengaged from people. So he sought solitude and silence. These are the two major things that every church planter needs once a week, the Sabbath day, where you pray and play. You solitude and silence are your best friends. By being in solitude, we break the drug of being needed. The church planter is addicted to being needed. And he is addicted to people around him. And the more people around him, the more people that need him, the more fulfilled he feels. So you have to break the addiction of people to people and being needed. And you do that by escaping from people. Go off into the hills, into the mountains. Go off alone into the woods.
But go away from people for a day and stop talking. The major tool in the toolbox of the church planter is his tongue. We manage our ministry through our tongues. We are the talking ministers. So almost everything we do with our tongues. And when we stop talking, we realize two things. We have a soul. The most empty people I know of in this world are people who can't stop talking. When I'm with a person who is just a, you can hardly stop him from talking. Sometimes when I have the opportunity to stop him, I say, tell me about your emptiness. He covers his emptiness with his words. It's powerless speaking. No power behind it. It's just fluff. He's covering something up. There's a great need that he is trying to cover up with his words. When we stop talking, what happens is we realize we have a soul. This goes back to Dallas Willard, one of my profs at Fuller. Read everything that Dallas has written. Read everything, imbibe it, live it. But you realize you have a soul. And after you've been quiet, you have something to say. You know, God created our creation, our world, out of silence. And then he spoke, and it was. Only after we have been silent for significant periods of time will we realize we have something to say, and it will be powerful. Yeah, Jenna is nodding because she knows. So, but most of us are high I's and high D's in church planting. The church planting leaders are high D's and high I's. So we are driven, and we are activists, we are project-oriented, we are goal-oriented, we've got lots of people around us, and what we need to do is we need to exit from all that in order to save ourselves and our ministries. We need to pay attention to these things in the personal life of the church planter. We need, as coaches, to be attentive to the forward-moving dynamic in the church planting ministry. If the church plant has stagnated, you don't go the next step. You've addressed the stagnation. Why is there stagnation? What can we do to create a new growth curve? Do not go further if there's stagnation or decline. Decline is even worse. But you need to try to help him to create a forward-moving dynamic. And then you have to help him to make disciples and not just members or workers or baptisms or conversions. But does he really know how to make disciples that make disciples? Does he have a plan? Is it working? How well is it working? Is he doing it through others intermediately, or is it all his work? Is he the direct influence, or is he doing it indirectly through others? That's where you want him to get to. Because if he is doing the discipleship all by himself, he will be the bottleneck of his church plant. He will not get beyond himself, which is what you need. What is disciple making? Does he know how to make disciples? Mike Breen's work, 3DM, Soma, lots of good stuff out there these days that is not program driven, which is very important. And we live in a fast-paced society in Europe, and we need ways in which to disciple people who are fast-paced. We're going to plant a church in Frankfurt among people in the financial sector. So we're going to need Jim to come over here to help us to leave rainy Arizona, cold Arizona, to come to sunny Frankfurt and help these poor bankers, these millionaires, these up-and-outers, to find new life and really life in and of itself. But we know that these people have very little discretionary time. So we will use the 3DM system to disciple them, creating hubs and moving out from there. Secondly, you need, or fourthly, you need to make sure that they are raising up leaders. Yes?
Can I ask a question?
Yes,
on
sure.
Since
I will repeat the question after you ask it.
Since practicing the
yes.
spiritual life of the church planter, how does that play into the longevity of his Christian life? The asking is, how young can a church planter be? Does it make sense?
How young in the faith?
Ah, okay.
Can
yeah.
a church planter be?
Okay.
Since you know, if we talk about yeah. spiritual beasts, yeah. that's something that might develop yeah. as maturity.
Right. Right. Yeah, that's a great question. You must be a great leader. Great leaders ask great questions. Yeah.
Cool.
He is asking in terms of the spiritual disciplines, how. That are very, very important in order for us to finish well. And the great book on this is The Making of a Leader by J. Robert Clinton. He says only about 30% of leaders will make it to retirement and to convergence and afterglow, where all of your gifts, your experiences, your knowledge, your spirituality come together for the highest ministry impact in your life. It's the end of your life. But only 30% of us make it there. And spiritual disciplines is the best way to make it there. How young can you be to be in this process? You could be a teenager in your late teenage years if you're coached well. If you're coached well. This is not a thing about age. It's a thing about maturity and hunger. Are you hungering for God? And are you doing the disciplines regularly? Now, the disciplines that we need are not the disciplines of engagement. They're the disciplines of disengagement. We're very good as evangelicals doing the disciplines of engagement, like Bible study, witnessing, celebration, acts of good service, doing things. What we need are the disciplines of to stop doing things, to stop talking, to stop being with people. These are the things that we need. Incidentally, the spiritual disciplines are like medicine. You take them as you need them. You take aspirin when you have a headache. There is a corresponding spiritual discipline for every malaise that you have. Like if you're battling pride, you think too much of yourself, you live by the motto, I'll say it in German, meine Frau und ich, wir lieben mich wahnsinnig. My wife and I, we love me wildly. If that's your problem, that you and your wife love you, you know, in a wild fashion, that's your problem. You're full of yourself, your pride, you're a vain person, and you need a discipline that would not just wound it, but kill it. How do you kill pride? Well, the way to kill pride is to do good things for people that cost you something without being seen. Pride is fueled by being seen, by appearing good in the eyes of others. But when you do good things that cost you much and you don't get seen, nobody knows who did this, what it does is it kills your pride and your vanity. I have somebody very close to me. If I told you her name, this month we've been married for 34 years. I'm not going to say who it is, but if I told you her name, I would just, you know, spoil it. But she's not a proud person, but she does this. Somebody goes on vacation, they come back and they find their lawn is mowed, their garden is weeded, everything is in better shape than when they left. They say, who did this? Nobody knows. I know. That's the way she is. And she's not full of herself. She's full of Jesus. When I was at Trinity Seminary 40 years ago, in the ancient days, when there was no email or anything like this, I had a professor of homiletics by the name of Dr. Lloyd Perry. Did you have him?
He already left.
Okay, yeah. Well, you know, what most evangelicals in the 70s and 80s didn't know was that most of the stellar preachers like Warren Wiersbe, yeah, they were trained by Dr. Perry. And when Wiersbe took over Moody Church, there was this insulation service, and Dr. Perry was asked to do the message for the insulation service. So thousands of people came, and they looked at the program, and they said, oh, we know Wiersbe, but who's Perry? We had never heard of Perry. But what they didn't know was behind Wiersbe, there was Perry. And Dr. Perry, who was a small man, he was even shorter than I am, was injured by polio as a child, so he walked with a limp. He said once in class something that I have not ever gotten over. He said, and tears were streaming down his face when he said this, he said, I would rather be a kingmaker than a king. I thought, was this Jesus that just spoke? This is Jesus. This is all about ministry. We are serving others and cheering them on to be more successful than we have been. The joy of us as older leaders is the success of the people that we are empowering. Our joy is their fruit and seeing that we are a part of them being fruit makers. So, in terms of your ministry life, I hope that you stop counting the numbers of conversions, the numbers of churches you planted, the numbers of baptisms, how big your churches have gotten, and begin to count the numbers of young leaders that you have empowered and trained during your lifetime. Your spiritual legacy when you leave this world is a cadre of young leaders that you have left behind. That would all say, if it weren't for him, if it weren't for her, I would have never gotten to where I've gotten. Of course, it's the Lord's doing and the Holy Spirit's working, but there are people of God behind these people. And then bifocal vision. You need to lead your people to look beyond their church plant to see the next church plant. I have bifocals. I'm 56 years old. I look like I'm 55, though, you know. But if you're over 40, you're going to need bifocals. Jesus never had glasses, but he lived with bifocal vision. He always looked into the harvest, and he said, that is the future of our church. Most ministers have myopic vision, nearsightedness. The longer they're in ministry, the more they're pulled gravitationally into the ministry itself, and it keeps them from breaking into the harvest. Sick and dying churches, you need to write this down. Sick and dying churches in Germany, this is probably not the case in the Czech Republic or Estonia, but in Germany, sick and dying churches will emphasize three things. The members, the youth, and the building. When a church has built, it is like they have reached the Mount of Transfiguration. This is the highest point. There is nothing greater than the building. But you know what? The members, the youth, and the building, they all have to be kept up. You have to service these, you know? And Jesus would have never said what we hear in our churches. Jesus would never say that the youth is the future of our church. In my context, I hear that all the time. Why would he not say that? Because not the youth that we have is the future of the church. The youth that are not yet in the church or converted could be the future of the church. The future of every movement and the future of the church planting movement is in the harvest field and not in the barn. The building is the barn. And it is a means to an end. So what you need to do is convey the vision that you can be thankful but not satisfied with your church planter. Thankful but not satisfied. From this church plant, there needs to be a church planted. The sign of a healthy church is a church that is healthy enough to reproduce itself. And in terms of movement, in my last chapter in the Jesus model, I give seven characteristics of movement. And one seminal characteristic is generational distance. So getting away from the first cause. Many good church planting churches are bad in that they are always in the direct position of planting churches. They are the energy that does it. They themselves. So they plant a church, then they recover. They plant another church, they recover. They plant another church, they recover. That will never get to a movement. You need to remove yourself from the first cause. My wife's grandparents were married for 75 years when they died. Grandfather was 105. Do you know this? Have I ever mentioned this? Yeah. Rich is humble. Yeah. He's heard this, but he needs to hear it again. Grandfather was 105 when he died. Grandmother was 97 when she died. They had 8 kids, farmers. One died. But when they died, they left a progeny of 150 people. We have a picture of them holding our firstborn, which was a fifth generation, in their arms. This is the picture of multiplication. Did they produce our son? No, they couldn't have. But indirectly, they did. Indirectly, they did. And that is the power of movement, the power of indirect influence. You've got to get away from the first cause. And you need to instill this vision in the church planter that's planting his church, who is consumed. 120% of his energy is consumed with his project. But you have to still get him to look beyond that. I know it's difficult, but he needs to know what he's to do in the first 3 years of his church plant. If a generation is 3 years in Europe, and I think we can get to a 3-year generational gestation period in terms of just church planting, in the first year of your church plant, you guide him to prayerfully discover his next church planting leader, somebody who's fat, faithful, available, teachable. Yeah? These are the character qualities that this person needs to have. So he identifies this future church planter in the first year of his church plant. In the second year, he teaches him everything that he knows, which is not much, but he teaches him everything he knows. In the second year, he mentors him. In the third year, he gives him a leadership responsibility in the church plant. It could be leading the small group leaders. It could be leading the discipleship track. It could be leading the children's ministry. But he has leadership, so he leads others. And then at the end of that time, the end of the third year, you give him a fishing license that says he has the right to take as many as 10 people away from this newly planted church, from the mother church, in order to form a starter team to start the next church. He can have anybody but my wife, okay? The sky's the limit. And he has to convince them to leave. That's the other thing. But a good leader will get good people to go with him. So if you did this every 3 years, after 15 years, you would have 32 churches and a fifth generation. And it is the generation that you want to get to. And then you won't need the first cause, the Urkraft, to keep your movement going, because it will be going, ongoing. Okay, these are some of the things that we need to be aware of so that we don't make these mistakes in our own coaching ministry of the church planters that we guide. So, I've said enough. What would you like to talk about? Yeah, that needs to be, how directive am I in getting the church planter to get his model and locking into it and getting him down on the path? I think this is one of the first things he needs to do. After being sure of his call with his wife or spouse, he needs to then begin to be to acquaint himself with different models, and then to say, what is the model that would best fit my personality, my gift mix, and the context in which we're going to do this? Not one size does not fit all. There are different models for different people and contexts. So he needs to be basically, before he even starts his starter team, he needs to have this in his mind and heart. Not to say that the Lord can't correct along the way. And he will. But you need to have some sort of structure or framework in mind up front. Yeah. Great question. You must be a great leader.
Learning from Giovanni. I don't know about that. I'm going to ask a very personal question because of the context we had the launch.
Yeah, great question. In terms of a house church model of planting churches, what are some steps that one can take toward a launch? Well, this is my personal bias, okay? I think, when I think house church, I think you need something that is more cell church model. Ralph Naber talks about it being like a bird with two wings. You need the house church itself, the cell, but then you need the big celebrations. And so to draw the house churches together periodically, once a month or once a quarter, so that people in the city can see there is a huge mass of Christians in this place that we live in that I was not aware of. Or even the Christians to know that we are part of a bigger group of believers here. The problem or the danger in house church is that we feel so alone and so small and so insignificant. In an urban area, you need to get attention. And you do that by the big celebrations. And then you need to give non-Christians the gift of anonymity. They need a place to explore Christianity without being noticed. They can't do that in a house church. You come in there and, I mean, there are 13 people there. You're the new person and everybody knows it. But in a gathering of 300 people, you can be anonymous and nobody knows that you're new, which is the gift for a non-Christian. It is a gift. And you want to give him that gift periodically, even if you have a house church movement. So I would encourage you to think about clusters of house churches. So how work toward clusters. And then those clusters should meet together for big celebrations periodically to give people in the city the impression and the realization God is at work here in a major way. And there are some things that you can do in a big meeting in terms of impact that you cannot do in a house. Yeah. Yeah. Yes?
You had mentioned breaking the 70 people barrier in a church. And my question for you is, what do you feel is an optimal size for a church when maybe you could look at multiplying that congregation to kind of almost more of a multi-site model, but to reach different areas and also maintain community. Anyway, in your experience here, what have you noticed?
Yeah. What is an optimal size
To have a fellowship and also to multiply
right.
it?
Right, yeah, to have a fellowship and also to multiply it. In our German context, it would be about 60 members to support a pastor and 80 to 100 members to support a pastor and pay for a building, either the rent or the mortgage. The issue ultimately is not size, it is health. How healthy is the church? You could have a church of 300 and it's totally dysfunctional. You could have a church of 50. In fact, there's a church in Los Angeles that is one of the world's premier church planting churches. It never gets beyond 50 members. But every year, it sends out 10 of its members. And they plant a new church, and the daughters or the progeny churches are much bigger than the mother. And the mother can do it because it is healthy, and they know how to make disciples. So I would look for quality before I looked for quantity. Quantity plays a role, but I think the quality issue is the greater issue. Yeah. What the two questions is are, what is a disciple? Yeah. And how well are we making disciples? Those are the two questions we need to ask. And do we have a really good plan to do it? And get away, cut everything away that is extraneous to that. As the church grows, what you'll have to do is prune the church, its structures that have outgrown their use. And you need to get rid of structures. Every time a church doubles in size, you will not have half of the leaders that are in your leadership team that will be able to take the next level. You'll have to sort out half of your leaders, and you probably have to get retool about half of your structures. Your goal is, if this is the number in your fellowship in a worship service, say these are 100 people. Well, your goal is to, during the week, to empty this content into smaller, what do you call this? Cups. And the goal is that you take a church attendance and divide it by 10, and then you know how many small groups you need. But in terms of your planning, your annual planning, never plan in terms of your actual size. Plan it as if your church were double in size. So you may have 100 people attending, but when you go to planning, you think as if you were a 200 people church. And then you ask yourself, well, how many small group leaders do we need? how many children's groups do we need? How much money do we need? How much space do we need? Do we have the space for 200 people? What do we need to do to move that direction? Never think on par of your size, but always twice as big. And also address the question, when are we planting the next church? With whom? Who is our next church planter? And how are we doing getting him along that path? Do a flow chart. I call it a flow chart. And ask yourself, how are non-Christians coming into our church? And how is the church going into the world of non-Christians? And then when they come into your church, how do you lead them from one instance to the next? What do you do? Like, if they come into a worship service, the next step would be maybe to get them into the newcomer group. Perhaps, if you have something like that. And then to an alpha or a my life. And then a small group. Perhaps a ministry. And then leadership. So ask yourself, what are we actually doing to make disciples? And what does it look like? How do people flow through our system of disciple making? And how good are they when they've come out? The good disciples are sent back into the harvest field. They don't necessarily remain in the barn. They're sent back out. And they do it all over again. They make disciples. So, other questions? Great insights.
I have one.
Sure.
What is the biggest mistake you've ever made in church planting? Like you say, this was a big mistake.
What is the biggest mistake I have ever made? You know, looking at the time, it's time to close. Biggest mistake is having you in the seminar. No, I'm kidding. I love you, and I think the world of you. You're a great gift to Estonia and to your wife. That's a great question. You must be...
and uncomfortable.
The greatest mistake I've ever made as a church planter. I can't think of one. I can think of many. I mean, if your name is Schindler, you have a Schindler's list of the greatest mistakes you've ever made. Let me just rattle off a number.
You have a propensity towards. You know, it's just kind of something that you often return to because of your personality or gifting or something.
Using people to get to my goals. Mm-hmm. I'm a high D. And in the first part of my ministry, I was an unsanctified high D. I,
I'm, you know, Heidi is the dominant personality. Everything else is flat in my personality makeup. I'm a driven person. I'm a goal-oriented. I will reach my goals. It's not a, I never think, am I going to fail? I have never had a second of my life where I've ever thought I would fail. I knew I would succeed, and I've always succeeded. I'm never surprised when I succeed, okay? So I am a very driven person. I'm a very goal-oriented person, but I have misused people to get to my goals. A high D who is not sanctified will walk over corpses to get to where he needs to go. Beware of who I am. If you're on my team, you need to beware of me. I could be very, very difficult. I don't care that you have a soul, a high D. He wants to know how effective you are. So that, I think, in terms of my personality type, that was the major thing that I learned that was terrible. It was terrible. Yeah. Yuri.
I have a question about, you know, you were responsible for the church planting in your denomination.
Yeah.
How have you recruited coaches or trained them?
Yeah.
What was the process with them?
We have, once a year, we ask people to get coaching training. And then we do a specialized training for coaches for church planting. So somebody, he's gone through normal coaching training, and then we do an extra two-day training for just coaching for church planters. So what are special qualities?
What did it look like? How did you design the training?
Well, like my model in the poem and in my book. And they do it has to be a lot of hands-on. They have to do this in triads with one another. That's how they learn. You learn by doing it. And then they have to report back after they've done it in their local context. They come back, they report back. How was it? What went well? What do they need to work on? Often it's the lack of listening. They're not really listening to the people that they're coaching. They have some agenda, you know, that they want to get across. You have to suspend the agenda for a certain time in the coaching process in order to really connect with that person. So we do have a structure in place for training of church planting coaches.
It sounds like it's two steps.
Right.
You invite everyone to coaching,
right.
And then you invite some to church planting.
Exactly. We have the two-tier thing. Yeah, right. Those who have gone through the formal coaching training, it's done by a psychologist, a Christian psychologist, Christoph Schalk in Germany, who used to work with Bob Logan. He's very good. He's very expensive, too. But he should earn all he can, to save all he can, to give all he can. So, but then from that, those who are in church planting ministry, we invite them to the specialized coaching for church planters. Yes?
We as coaches, shouldn't we also have a coach?
Yes, we as coaches should also have a coach. Yes. Or a mentor. And there are different kinds of mentors. Some are living, some are far away, some are in books. Some, you know, you only see it once or twice a year. Some you've never met.
Maybe also outside of your own setting.
Yes, outside of our own setting. Sometimes we need that because in terms of openness, in terms of new perspective, yeah. Let me tell you, Dan, please.
Well, yeah.
No? Yes? Yes?
Do you have a structure for coaching within your denomination? Is it done regionally? Is it done by models? How do you structure who's coaching whom? And also, do you ever have issues of chemistry or where the coach, is assigned? And how does that work if you have personality?
Yeah. Do we have coaches regionally or throughout the country? Do we assign coaches? Yes. We will not start a church. We will not invite somebody to be a church planter if he does not have a church planting coach.
Right.
We will allow him the freedom to seek out his coach, and we will give him some suggestions. But he will find his own coach, and that is somebody who knows coaching and has been a church planter.
So you, by and large, these coaches are also in the region in which the church planter lives so that they can meet personally on, you know, regularly, every 6 weeks or two months at the latest. So we do that, yeah, yeah. Let me close by saying, when I was 14, I bought my first vehicle. I had no driver's license, but I saw this beautiful truck, a 1956 Ford pickup truck.
Oh, yes.
It was beautiful, beautiful. It was, it didn't run. I had money saved up, $400. I bought the truck, and my father and I, we towed it back home, and we took it all apart, and we discovered why it was not running. The connecting rods were broken to the pistons. They were broken. So we replaced the connecting rods, the pistons, we put it all together, and it ran beautifully, beautifully, wonderfully. And I had my license when I was 16. In America, you can do these things. It's not against the law. But after I was driving my truck for 4 or 5 months, my brother was next to me. I looked in my rearview mirror, and I saw this great big cloud of black smoke coming up behind us. And I laughed to my brother, and I said to him, "You know what? There's some poor guy who's about to lose his engine." I knew what this black smoke meant, you know. And I was joking with him about this poor guy. So we come to a stop, a traffic light, a red light. All of a sudden, the hood of this beautiful truck starts to vibrate as if it were an earthquake. And then the whole vehicle begins to vibrate. And then this black cloud of smoke envelops us. And I realize I'm this poor guy who's about to lose his engine. I lost the engine. It burned out. It literally burned out. We towed it away. We took it all apart. And we discovered this was the reason why it didn't run the first time. I'm losing my English grammar. the oil lines were plugged up. It had sat in a field for years and years, and the oil lines were plugged up. There was no lubrication getting to the pistons. Coaching is the oil in the motor of your ministry that will keep people from burning up. And if you don't have coaching, you're going to have church planters that are going to burn up and seize up. But if you have a good coaching system, you'll have strong, vibrant, productive, joy-filled leaders who will plant churches that plant churches. And you may even have movement leaders. This is ultimately your goal, to get to a movement, a fifth generation. And you have a significant role to play in that. Without you, that probably won't happen. So thank you. Thank you for your role and for your ministry. And may the Lord use you to be kingmakers. Yeah, and to have many, many young leaders in your countries that are excellent church planters because of your investment in them.
Thank you.
Sure.
Thank you.